It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We've got a show of challenges today. Mario Batali is taking on another first in his life. It involves Food & Wine magazine and maybe a new career. Deborah Madison, the master cook and vegetable savant, challenges us to raise the spring radish to full vegetable status. No more limiting it to the garnish department. And even more challenging is her idea of setting our plants free to be themselves. We bring you a beer profiler, and our global travelers, the Perennial Plate Team, discover a thrill-seeking way to farm in Sri Lanka. Stick around for this and more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, if you open up the April 2013 issue of Food & Wine magazine and check the masthead, you'll see something that has never appeared between those covers. Something that breaks a precedent. Along with editor-in-chief Dana Cowan's name, there's a new title, guest editor Mario Batali. Dana Cowan, editor-in-chief of Food & Wine magazine, and Mario Batali join us from New York. Hey, you two. Welcome. Good to have you here.
We're so happy to be here.
I'm ecstatic.
Dana, give us the lowdown. I mean, you have never had anyone as a guest editor on the magazine in all the years that the magazine's been in print. So what happened with this guy?
Well, you know, I hate to share the spotlight, but there's one guy with whom I'm willing to do that, and that is Mario Batali. Our readers love Italian food. They have an endless, endless fascination for Italian every which way, and we've given it to them every which way, except the all Mario way. And let me tell you, this was the most fun I've had as an editor, being now, a co-editor.
But what's the scope of what an editor does? Because I don't think most of us realize what goes on, you know, behind the scenes.
Well, in the case of asking Mario to be the guest editor, I had a few things on my wish list. I wanted Mario to teach someone to cook because he's such an amazing teacher. And so I asked Mario if he wanted to do that. He's like, sure, who do you want? And he said, Jimmy Fallon. And I said, that would be good.
That's a good beginning, yeah.
And we also wanted Mario to do an interview because often editors will indeed do interviews. And Mario said, that sounds good to me. What about Jim Harrison? Done. And the amazing thing about having Mario do the Q&A, we didn't give him any guidelines. We just said, want you to have an interesting conversation. It has to have something to do with food. And you take it from there. And Mario's interview, which we have the full transcript of, it was masterful.
So, Mario, what was it like for you? You've never done this before.
I've never done this before. I've written, and I like to write. So I was excited about the prospect of writing or participating or seeing what happens in the world of editing. I had always assumed that there was this kind of grinding urgency as you approached the deadline. And maybe they put on airs for me, but this seemed like the most natural, flawless, and fun way to put together a project that I've ever seen. It was just a blast. And I'm always fascinated by how other people who do things really well do what they do. And I got to see a pretty inside scope on this, and it was great.
I have to know about the cooking lesson with Jimmy Fallon.
Well, let's just put it this way. It started in a swank, rented apartment in New York City, and we started cooking, and by the end of the entire episode, me, Dana, and Jimmy are in the bathtub with a lot of strawberries. That's all I have to say.
You are joking.
He actually is not, and is documented. It's in the issue, and it was very unexpected.
Right.
Should I ask, were you clothed or unclothed?
You should ask, and you know what? You should get the issue and check it out.
Oh, you're a stinker. You really are. Now, Jim Harrison, you two have known each other forever. And I personally find it difficult at times to interview people I really know. You know, it's hard to kind of step back. So, but you, how did you treat this?
I treated it like a conversation with Jim, and it invariably, very much like his books, weaves a lot of wide textures in together at the same time. We always talk about food, but we always talk about the outdoors. We talk about hunting. We talk about birds. We talk about dogs. We talk about places we like to sit. We talk about the way the wind smells on a Thursday afternoon when you're in Livingston, Montana. He is exactly how he reads in real life, and one of the greatest things about knowing him and then reading his books is that you hear him so clearly in every sentence.
Sounds like a total natural.
It is a natural, and he's so ready to be interviewed. He has so many things to say and always looks at life from a particularly illuminated level that always seems to be floating a little over the ground to me, that it's just always a fascination to talk with him, and it gives me great joy.
What ended up for you being the thing that either gave you pause or you felt was really challenging?
Not really anything. There was a one moment when we were discussing a particular pasta that I had given to one of the editors, and they decided that they were going to put cherry tomatoes in it. And I'm like, but this is an April issue, right? You know there aren't cherry tomatoes in the Northern Hemisphere. And we kind of dealt with it, and it worked out well. That was the bumpiest of the bumps, though.
To be fair, Mario was incredibly gracious, because what he said was, just, you know, this is not how I would do the pasta, but I understand covers, because it was the cover pasta mm-hmm. that we were talking about. And as we were cooking this together, because I was not going to let this issue happen without me getting a lesson from Mario, which is what I did accomplish with this cover recipe. So I wrote about it in my editor's page. But in the middle of the lesson, Mario turns to me and goes, you know, if we called this a Southern pasta, you would have cherry tomatoes in April. So I'm good with that.
Right.
So he came around. So it was okay.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you'll see
yeah.
the cover has... The other thing is that the cherry tomatoes that are on the cover still have their skins. Whereas the first thing Mario taught me was you get the tomatoes on the vine, you pop them in a really hot oven, and then basically you just pluck the little skins off of them. So Mario probably would never have a skin on his tomato, ever. He doesn't like the way it feels on your teeth.
That said, this cover looks beautiful.
Thank you.
So, Dana, are we going to be seeing some other names on the masthead in the future? Are you thinking about doing this again?
I hate to say it, but I think Mario sort of broke the mold. He was perfect. He can interview. He can write. He can teach. He was a pleasure. And I don't have a burning desire to do it again. I didn't, you know, it's my first time in 18 years. And it was a perfect experience. Sometimes, you know, you eat the perfect peach, you don't have to have more dessert. I think I've got the perfect guest editor. I'm not sure I need to have another one.
That makes sense. Dana, Mario, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dana Cowan is editor-in-chief of Food & Wine magazine. Chef Mario Batali guest-edited the April 2013 issue of the magazine. Master cook and vegetable savant is the best way to describe Deborah Madison. I've lost count of how many books she's done and how many awards she's won. What sets her apart is her own particular sensibilities about food, how it seems to ground her beliefs and the way she enjoys cooking. Deborah's a leader in the slow food and sustainable agriculture movements, but her main teacher right now seems to be the garden that she started next to her house in New Mexico. These elements come together in Deborah's latest book, Vegetable Literacy. Deborah, it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back here.
You've probably written at least a million words about vegetables and seasonal cooking. But this book is different. This book is written by somebody who has begun gardening.
Mm-hmm. I think once you get into the garden and that becomes, you know, your part of your source of food, you realize the difference between eating food that's really alive and that's kind of sort of alive, you know, that's been sitting around the store.
Right,
I think
right.
of it as languishing compared to like just picking things and bringing them in. But there's also a quality of, oh, I grew it. It's my baby. I love it no matter what. And you just eat the ugliest stuff and you're so happy.
And yeah,
because
yeah.
I am not a perfectionist gardener by any means. And I'm a beginning gardener and not everything comes out as it should. But, you know, I always feel like, oh my gosh, it grew under my watch. So there's sort of a feeling more of gratitude, I think.
You've divided the book into vegetable families, but there's one particular vegetable I want to talk to you about because it never gets used up in the refrigerator. It's the radish. Because normally most people look at a radish and they think, I'm going to slice it and I'm going to put it in a salad and that's it.
Well, what I like to do with raw radishes is to, first of all, find a couple of different varieties, and I especially love the ones that have the rose center and the pale green center, the red meat radishes, the watermelon, all of that. Mix them maybe with a turnip that has a really scarlet skin, maybe also adding in there a carrot, a purple skin carrot. I slice all of these like paper thin, and they get so translucent and delicate tasting too. And then I mix them all with some things like radish sprouts and maybe some of the radish leaves, a little salt and pepper, lemon juice, olive oil, and put in some very thin slices of a dry Monterey Jack cheese or an aged Jauja or maybe Manchego, which isn't the usual thing to do with radishes, but I think that the proteins and the casings and the cheese give it such a round, wonderful taste. It's one of my favorite salads, and it's absolutely beautiful.
It sounds gorgeous. The radish leaves, mm-hmm. eating radish leaves, what's your advice on this?
Well, you know, I looked at radish leaves, and I thought, that's interesting. They sort of look like arugula leaves, except they're spiny and rough. And but they're in the same family. You know, chances are they taste sort of similar. You know, radishes do produce lots of lovely green, dark green leaves. And so go through them, throw out the ones that aren't dark green anymore that have turned yellow, and mm-hmm. Give them a rinse, and you can braise them along with the roots. I love using the greens to make a radish soup, for example, with a mild base of potatoes, because they can get very strong, especially daikon radishes. And radish greens, if they're small, there's no reason you can't put them in a salad or sliver them and toss them with your slivered radishes, add them to a coleslaw.
How do you like to cook your radishes?
Well, I like to braise them if I'm going to cook them, just gently. I love to watch their colors fade. They go from being these bright kind of garish colors to these soft, muted spring colors. I think they work so beautifully with other things that may be doing well in your garden at the same time. You might have some peas, you might have a little bit of asparagus, you might have scallions, fava beans. I just cook them very gently all together. I might make a little stock with leek trimmings, the pea pods, the asparagus, you know, the peelings.
Right.
They just amplify that beautiful green flavor that's there in the mature vegetables.
Deb, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Deborah Madison's latest book is Vegetable Literacy. This is one for the kitchen and the reference shelf. Her recipe for spring garden hodgepodge is going to get you started with those radishes. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, believe it or not, spring is a time for turnips. Small, pearly ones with nearly transparent skins are what you want to look for. Now, this is when they can be sweet and crisp and almost like water chestnuts. You can peel and chunk them and then cook them in a skillet with butter and lemon peel and a little honey. Or you can do one of my favorite go-to sides, pureed turnips and potatoes with 20 cloves of garlic. So check out the website for spring turnips with garlic and potatoes. That's splendidtable.org. Now we're going to be back with the dangerous side of coconuts and The Man Who's Changing How America Orders Beer. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. PerennialPlate.com could give you itchy feet and wanderlust really fast, at least if you're curious about food. Its creator, Chef Daniel Klein, finds his way into home kitchens, onto farms and fishing boats, and he and his wife, camerawoman Mira Fine, have a goal, 12 countries in depth in 18 months. While they're just back from Sri Lanka, Daniel, Mira, good to have you back.
Great to be here.
So tell me about Sri Lanka, because I was looking at some of the notes on your site, and you talked about a family that has a coconut plantation.
Yeah. One of the really interesting things about the people in Sri Lanka is that for them, the coconut is really a source of life, not only because it is an ingredient that is found in most Sri Lankan foods, but also because the coconut tree in itself, from the trunk to the leaves to the actual nut, is used in non-food elements of their life as well. So when we landed in Sri Lanka, we wanted to set out to discover all the uses of the coconut, and we found a family who lived and owned a coconut plantation.
So how, I mean, coconut palms are, they're huge. I mean, they're like skyscrapers. How do they work, these trees?
Yeah, it's crazy. They free climb up this 100-foot coconut tree. And
I tried to climb up the coconut tree, by the way. I got about 3 feet.
So there is two ways that we saw how to climb a coconut tree. And one is interesting because they cut chunks of the coconut and tie it around the tree with rope made from fibers from the coconut that are spun. And uh-huh. they tie these at intervals up the coconut trunk.
So like a ladder.
So like a ladder, yeah.
Yeah,
like
a man-made ladder. And this guy
will...
A very scary ladder. This guy will climb up using no nets or, you know, safety rope to the top of the tree to tap for toddy, which is a type of alcohol that comes from the sap of a coconut tree.
It's like a coconut wine.
Ah, and it's at the top of the tree where it has to be done.
Yep, it's at the top of the tree where, you know, a shoot comes out that eventually turns into a flower that eventually will produce the nut. And before that flower comes out, they cut the bud.
Right.
And then they'll tie it off with a string that's made from, or more of a strap that's made from the actual coconut so that it can collect the sap. And then after 3 weeks, they go back up again and collect all the sap in a pot. And then they travel from one tree to the next. They tightrope walk from the top of one coconut tree to the next.
How tall are these trees?
These ones were at least 100 feet.
They're really tall. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
We put a camera on the guy's head for our videos so you can see him scaling this tree and then walking across.
And they pray to the tree before they climb up because they realize how dangerous it is. And they know that, you know, they're lucky to be safe on each of these trees. But yeah, they go from one tree to the next to collect all the sap. And then they finally come down with what is known as sweet toddy because it has not yet been fermented.
Or it's fermented like it's at about 1% alcohol at that point. So just overnight with the heat, it's already started to gain that fermentation. And then by that evening, it will have gone up to like 3 or 4% alcohol.
But not fermented enough to be called toddy.
Right.
Yeah. And the sweet toddy is amazing. We got to try it. It looks like, it kind of looks like lemonade in color.
Right.
And it tastes like sweet kombucha mixed
coconut
with
kombucha
coconut.
Kind of. Yeah,
like yeah.
A little bit effervescent. It's like, I was shocked. It was alive with crazy flavor and coconut sweetness. It's really delicious. But also, it had a lot of bees in it and different things. So
you want to filter it. So are they marketing this?
They are selling really every part of the coconut. They're selling the toddy to a toddy producer. They're selling their husks to a rope producer. They're selling the oil to an oil producer. And then they use the coconuts for their own cooking and also to build huts and things like that.
Every part of that plant figures into their lives in some way, right?
Yeah, even...
Every part. I mean, so their kitchen is outside of their house. It's in the backyard, and it's a makeshift hut that is made almost entirely from the coconut tree. So the structure is made out of beams that were made out of the trunk.
Right.
The roof is made from the coconut tree leaves that were woven and dried.
Uh-huh.
And the open fire, the firewood came from the coconut trees.
And as far as the food goes, I mean, we know about coconut milk. We know about shredded coconut. What other ways are they used?
Those are the primary uses that they use for it, but they use them in many different ways. So coconut milk is used in just about every single dish. One of the staples of Sri Lanka is sambal, so which is shredded coconut, and they grind it over a mortar and pestle. So onions, chili, sometimes dried fish or shrimp, and shredded coconut.
It's and amazing. Shallots.
Yeah, and they served it to us for breakfast with coconut rice. So they cook rice, and then they pour in a little coconut milk at the end, let it sit, and then serve it up.
Yeah, and then in true island style, they made a coconut roti, you know, which is like naan bread but a little bit more dense and round.
Yeah.
And they made that by mixing flour with shaved coconut, make it into a patty, and then placing it on a huge leaf that they put on top of a hot plate and then cooked it that way.
And then, of course, there's the coconut water, which has become popular, you know, like you buy it here in a little container.
Yeah.
But there, everywhere along the road, everyone is selling king coconuts just to crack open and drink. So I made it a point to have at least a coconut every day in Sri Lanka. And then they crack it open, they cut off a little piece and make a spoon out of the side of the coconut, and then you scoop out the inside and have this.
It's like pudding.
Yeah.
Thank you both.
Thanks for having us.
Chef Daniel Klein is creator of theperennialplate.com. Mira Fine handles the camera. For more information on their travels, go to the website splendidtable.org. And while you're there, dig into our recipe box, sign up for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and check out our e-books, Eating In with Lynn. It's all there for you at splendidtable.org. And while you're online, don't forget to reach out on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, or Tumblr. We are here for you in so many ways. Beer world, Pabst Blue Ribbon and Budweiser have made a strong comeback with 20-somethings, right alongside the likes of obscure brews like Zombie Dust and Furious. Now, if you've been confusing your Pilsners with your IPAs and Imperial Stouts, you need to meet up with Greg Angert. Greg has developed a flavor profile system. It's being used all over the country to help drinkers understand that beer is very much like wine. He's the beer director of the Neighborhood Restaurant Group in Washington, D.C. And we set him up with a self-professed beer hater, David Lead, to see what he could do.
Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, beer. I have to be up front right here. I hate beer. I really do. I find it very bitter. So, what do you have for me?
Well, it is a challenge, I'll be honest with you. I mean, beer's calling card for at least part of its history has indeed been bitterness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hops. Hops are the thing that give bitterness to beer. Also, roasted flavors you find in stouts and porters will give you an intense bittering quality. And there's no two ways around that. You know, I think you're going to have trouble with most beers.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily for us, we hope today, there are a few different flavor categories out there, styles of beer, that I think we might be able to sneak in under your radar.
All right. Well, that's cool. Now, you have two beers here.
Mm-hmm.
They fall into what categories?
So, and these are categories that I find that work for all people who are kind of trying to transition into beer. So we kind of call these transitional categories.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the one that's probably most approachable or people would understand the best is the fruit and spice category,
mm-hmm.
dominated by Belgian style ales. I say that because Belgian style ales are made literally all over the globe today, kind of, you know, people's takes on the Belgian ales. And so these beers tend to be on the sweeter side. They tend to be either completely bereft of bitterness or at least just a little bit of a drying quality there.
Okay.
So that's one. And that's going to be represented by Cellar Door from Stillwater Artisanal. And then the next one I even have probably more success with, especially for the wine drinker out there. Mm-hmm. You know, what most people don't realize is that for 99.9% of beer's history, which stretches back to the beginnings of civilization, 10,000 plus years ago, it was sour. And this is a beer called Madame Rose. It's from Goose Island out of Chicago, Illinois. And I think you'll find that it tastes more like, you know, almost like a Burgundian red wine than it does like
really?
Your typical beer.
And this falls into what category?
That's the tart and funky category.
I love that, tart and funky. Okay, so why don't you open them up and I will give them a try.
Absolutely.
I can't promise anything, but I know. I'm game.
So we're going to start with the cellar door.
Okay.
This is loosely based on a style of beer called Saison. Mm-hmm. This is a farmhouse ale style. It's brewed outside of Baltimore, but the style is from Belgium. And it's brewed with some wheat, so it's nice and crisp and refreshing, not too bitter, and it has a little bit of white sage added to the beer in the end. So.
Cool. So why in glasses?
We love to pour these into glasses. Do not drink beer directly from the can or bottle because flavor is 99% aroma. Mm-hmm. So you should be swirling it like you would a fine wine.
Oh,
you should get your nose right in there.
Absolutely. Okay, there's my nose. You know, there's a cider quality almost to this.
A touch of it, yeah.
Yeah. There is no bitterness for me.
It's just effervescence, really.
That's shocking. And so the second beer, let's talk about that one.
So in the tart and funky category, mm-hmm. this is Madame Rose from mm-hmm. Goose Island in Chicago. It is a sour red ale that is aged in wine barrels with cherries.
Oh, wow. That has a phenomenal nose on that. Beautiful color, too.
Doesn't it?
Oh, that's real crisp. There's a nice... that's
beautifully acidic. Amazing with food.
Yeah. What would you pair with this?
I would love this with a number of things. I love lamb chops mm-hmm. in this because think about it. It's got that Burgundy and red wine quality balancing mm-hmm. against the gamey intensity of the lamb. Ribeye steaks. Rich steaks, I think, do well. This almost sauces the dish.
Excellent. So talk about some of the other categories that you have in your
Absolutely.
Profile.
Crisp is a category that we like to use for any kind of those, you know, effervescent, refreshing beers like lagers and pilsners, things like that. Kind of beers that most people associate with the term beer. Hop is a category that brings in the kind of pale ales and IPAs.
Bitterness
mm-hmm. that you don't love too much. Then we have malt-driven beers. These are beers that capitalize on the grainy qualities, you know, toasty, nutty, caramelized, toffee-ish qualities. Mm-hmm. And then we go into roast. Roast is the stout, the porter. These taste like coffee and chocolate, latte, espresso, et cetera. And then probably one of the strangest categories, and the last one, is smoke. These are beers that are produced with grain that's literally cooked over open fires, mm-hmm. giving the grain and the resulting beer the flavors of the fuel. So it'll taste kind of smoky and meaty and spicy.
So are you up for a pop quiz?
Absolutely.
All right. Knowing your categories and uh-huh. knowing your profiles, I'm going to give you the name of a dish. Okay. You tell me what you would pair it with.
Sure.
Okay. Shrimp and grits.
Shrimp and grits. Love this with something that's peppery, got a good fruit and spice quality. So we're thinking the fruity, spicy beers. Triples are fantastic with this. Belgian-style triples.
Spicy beef chili.
Spice is tough. Alcohol and bitterness will make spice intensify on the palate. Mm-hmm. So what we want to do with something spicy is use something crisp that can kind of wash away the intensity of heat, or something sweet like a malty beer that's going to also temper the flames.
Excellent. Barbecued ribs with a vinegar mustard-based sauce.
Anytime you get acidity, you want to match acidity or with sweetness. So I would go towards maybe even something like the Madame Rose, a tart and funky beer
that has a sort
of vinegary note to it mm-hmm. to kind of intensify that.
Okay, this is going to be a bit of a trick question. A stout cake, which is a cake made with Irish stout.
Right. Most people think that if something's made with something, you naturally pair it with that.
Exactly.
Now, that would be the easy way out, and you can do that. What I like to do is to bring something that's kind of fruity into the stout cake. So typically, if you have a chocolatey cake, maybe we're going to bring in a sweeter, fruitier beer. Mm-hmm. There's fantastic raspberry lambics out there that have this kind of sweet, mildly sour quality that are going to almost bring in a sauce to the cake itself.
Okay, and the last one, pasta with butter and Parmesan cheese.
Just very simple.
Very,
easy.
Which I make all the time, so help me.
It's fantastic. One of the best crisp beers out there is something called Kolsch. It typically comes from Cologne. And this is a crisp beer that's got a little bit of a delicate fruity note, some sweetness, bold effervescence, and almost no bitterness again. So you don't have to worry about the bitterness overwhelming the delicate flavors of the pasta.
Excellent. These are wonderful ideas. It was a pleasure having you, Greg. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Greg Engert is the beer director for the Neighborhood Restaurant Group, which includes Church Key and Blue Jacket in Washington, D.C. David Lee is the mind behind LeetsCulinaria.com.
Yeah. Look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said, look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
It is time to connect with you. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252 is the number. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, go to splendidtable.org. Well, May's calling from Cincinnati. May, what is up?
Hi. Well, I had a question about salmon. I like to cook it at home, but when I do that, sometimes I notice that it gets this sort of white gelatinous substance.
And
I've never seen that when I get it at restaurants, so I'm assuming that maybe I'm doing something wrong and wondered if you could guide me toward a better technique.
Okay, so what you're seeing really is, I'm not sure if they're proteins, but it's a very natural thing. Nothing is wrong with what you're doing. Often that kind of thing is scraped off in a restaurant. If you grill it, you know, if you put it in a pan and sear it on both sides and get it kind of a little bit brown and then put it in a low oven, like 300 degrees, generally that doesn't happen. But if it happens, just scrape it off. I mean, it's edible. There's nothing wrong with it. But if it doesn't look attractive enough for you, just take it off.
Okay.
But just remember, one of the things with salmon is, and this is true of a lot of animal proteins, the slower you cook it, the better. So what you're doing makes a lot of sense. If you wanted to even cook it more slowly in the oven, you know, it wouldn't hurt. It just takes longer. But the slower you cook it, the more moisture it's going to retain. So
how long should it take?
Well, let's put it this way. If it's, let's say, about an inch and a half to 2 inches thick, generally it's about 20 minutes. It's 10 minutes to an inch, more or less. And so what you could do is sear it, you know, get it just a fast brown and a little bit of some sort of fat on top of the stove really quick because you don't want to cook it fast. You just want to sear it. And then you could put it in a 300-degree oven and give it about 15 minutes and check it at that point and then see if it needs more time.
And how do you know when it is done? Is it just preference?
I press on it, and if it's starting to firm up, it's there. The other thing, I mean, you can take its temperature, but the reality is, I cut into it and I look. And if it seems to be, you know, cooked all the way through, I don't want it overcooked. I don't want it flaking because that can get a bit on the dry side. But if it looks like it's moist, but it's kind of cooked through, you know, it no longer has that raw look to it where it's bright pink. Uh-huh. I'm there. I'm done. And give it about a 5 minute rest, 5 to 10 minute rest before you serve it, because that lets all the juices settle. And you can do that with any meat or fish you cook. It's a great trick. Okay?
But, okay, great.
Yeah, so scrape it off if it doesn't look good.
Okay,
May.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye.
We're going to be back to take more of your calls and check into a try before you buy school for wannabe farmers. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. Okay, it is time to get back to your questions. Pick up the phone. Give us a call, 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org or check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Sarah's calling from St. Paul. Sarah, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me on the show.
You are welcome.
Thanks. Well, I am an artist. I live in the Lower Town artist community, and I have at least once a month, frequently more because of the First Friday events that we have here and the art crawl. Plus, I have my own open studio. I want some refreshments for my guests and for potential buyers. And this is going to sound a little bit off the wall, but so the nature of my work is I call it upcycling or budget artisan. So it's taking recycled materials and turning them into new and beautiful, like, items for the home. And
doesn't sound weird at all. It sounds fascinating.
Thank you. And so, like, in the spirit of this kind of, like, eclectic budget artisan, I want to offer a wine pairing of wine and Little Bevy cakes.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's great. I love it.
And I wanted to offer I wanted to offer one for every month, like a different featured one, so that, like, people can have some new fun thing to expect every month.
So, but along the line of the Little Debbie cake, like a Cheetos and something pairing or that kind of thing, is that what you're thinking?
Well, actually, it's funny. I hadn't even thought beyond a, like, Little Debbie, like, into, like, other
snacks. I mean, do you want that kind of thing to be a theme? Of snack foods
absolutely.
Or foods that normally people would turn their nose up at, but you're going to do a wine pairing with them and it could be really a hoot.
Yeah. Like, see, I was thinking of the cakes because it's like, you know, wine and chocolate is kind of a winner. And I don't really know what I'm doing.
The answer to the Little Debbie question, this was answered a long time ago on the show. It was very interesting. Josh Wesson, great wine guy with the most wonderful sense of humor. And one of the first times he had done a thing with us called Fast Food, Fast Wine, you know, like, what would you drink with a McDonald's, you know, hamburger? and because the point was that if you know what to pair with fast food, you know what to pair with the basic flavors of almost anything. Like, his point with a Big Mac was, you're not pairing that with meat. You're pairing it with the special sauce. And it's sweet. And it's a little spicy. So that you see, so I thought I'd really stump him, and I said, "What would you drink with a Twinkie?" Which is just like your Little Debbie.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing he said, and it made so much sense, Asti Spumante.
Oh my God!
Right. Think about it, though. Right.
Right.
It's like it's sweet. It's a wine most people would turn their nose up at. You know, who are wine connoisseurs? The rest of the world thinks it's swell. And the reality is, with a Little Debbie cake or anything like that, it's great. And you're not going to spend a fortune on it. Now, with the Cheetos, for instance, I don't know if you want to do Cheetos, but something like that.
Sure.
Deliciously greasy, a bit spicy, very salty. Believe it or not, a sparkling wine would really work there as well. But you want something drier, like a cava. From Spain, a Cristalino is really kind of inexpensive, and it's just delicious. Because you're probably on some kind of budget, right? I would imagine that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Artists generally, you know, you want to spend money on material. So, okay. Now let's think. What else would you think about pairing with?
Let's see. Well, how about like Keebler cookies or something like that?
Oh yeah, they're buttery. Again, a little sweet. A hint of salt. Oh, you know what would be really nice with that? Is Merlot in a box. There are some boxed wines. If you check our website, you'll find some recommendations for brands of boxed wines, which I cannot remember now off the top of my head, that are really great. And a Merlot, which is kind of, it's a red, but it's soft. You know, it usually has a lot of fruit to it. And it can be a really respectable wine, and have that with something like Keebler crackers.
Oh my God!
If you wanted to have some fun, you could have American cheese, you know, or Cheese Whiz. I think that would be a great combination. There you go.
Absolutely brilliant. Thank you, Lynn.
You are welcome, and great success. Hey, thanks for calling.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too, Sarah. Bye.
Bye.
800-537-5252. That's how you can call us. You can send us an email at splendidtable.org, or you can check us out on Twitter and Facebook. And Facebook is where Jim contacted us. He had a question. He explained that his girlfriend makes tomato sauce for spaghetti, lasagna, whatever, and she always puts a couple of carrots in the pot, and she claims that it soaks up the starch. And evidently she's stunned that Jim loves to eat the carrots. And he teases her by saying, well, they're good because they're full of starch. Well, this is his question. He didn't know that there was any starch generated by a tomato sauce, and he was unaware that carrots could act like a starch sponge. So he wants to know, is his girlfriend a little confused, or is he confused? Well, Jim, no insult to your girlfriend, but generally tomato sauces don't have starch in them. The tomato is made up of a lot of things, but mainly acids and sugars. But the carrot sweetens the sauce. Two whole carrots would just give it a little bit more sweetness. I don't know about carrots' ability to absorb things. Now, potatoes are famous for this, of extra salt and that kind of thing. But carrots, not so sure. Thanks for a great question. Terry is on the line from Frederick, North Carolina. Terry, what do you want to talk about?
Well, congee, which I guess is a rice porridge that I had once when I was in Hong Kong.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right.
And I've tried making it a couple times. I really loved it when I was over there, but I just can't get the consistency right, and I don't know what they put in it, but it had some kind of fish or something in it. I was hoping you could help me get the recipe.
If I remember correctly, congee is almost a porridge. It's this slightly thick or thicker, creamy almost, right? I mean, it's overcooked rice in one sense. But here's the thing. It often is done with chicken or fish that is, the process is called velveting.
Okay.
And this, what you do is you take a cleaver or a knife and you take boneless, something like a chicken breast and or a fillet of fish. And you keep chopping and chopping and chopping and chopping and chopping until it is like a pudding.
Okay.
And then you've cooked the rice. And I think short grain or medium grain rice is used because that becomes creamy. And you cook that rice until you have almost a porridge consistency. And then very, very gently add that velveted fish or chicken. But I'll tell you a source that would be totally as authentic as you could get. Eileen Fei Lo is a brilliant, brilliant Chinese cookbook author. And she did, her most recent book, if I remember, is called The Art of Chinese Cooking. And it's an overview, you know, I mean, it's a general book about many areas of China. And any congee recipe you can find by her, she's done quite a few books, would be just spot on. Another author is Grace Young. She's another one where she will nail that baby down and give you something dynamite. Both of them, any large bookstore with a good cookbook selection is going to have their books. And you'll be able to get a real hold on this because it's a wonderful thing. It's so delicate. Is that what you recall, the delicacy of it?
Absolutely. I actually had it for breakfast, and I kept going back to the same shop. It was off the beaten path, and I've never seen it again since I've been here in the States, but it was wonderful.
It is a breakfast item, and sometimes there's a little bit of rice wine in it. You know, there's different seasonings, but it's always this very gentle, very comforting kind of thing. And if there are any places that specialize in dim sum that are open early in the day, they may serve it. But you can do it yourself. So try those two sources, and I think you're going to find what you want.
Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome. Take care.
Bye.
Tara from L.A. had a question about scallops. She wants to know how to cook them and where should she get them. Okay, Tara, the first thing you want to do is buy scallops at a place that has a really fast turnover in their seafood. And you want to be able to give them a sniff before you buy them. If they smell fishy or whatever, you don't want them. Now, with scallops, if you overcook them, you end up with rubber. So what you want to do is sear them on the outside, fairly high heat, a generous amount of fat, and get them brown on both sides fairly quickly, and then stop. Just set them aside, give them about 5 minutes or 10 minutes before you serve them, and the heat will continue to cook them all the way through, and they'll be deliciously tender. If you want to cook them slowly and kind of poach them, you can do butter poaching, where you put a generous amount of butter in the pan, and then you roll the scallops. You keep the heat fairly low, and you slowly cook those scallops, rolling them around in that butter, until when you press them, they have just a little bit of resistance. And then immediately out of the pan, pour the butter over them, give it a squirt of lemon, you're home free. Thanks for a great question. You can reach us, friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email, splendidtable.org. You may not have noticed, but this is the era of the farmer as food star, which is great. But along with this comes the farmer wannabes. They bet everything on a farm where they can live the sustainable life, except they don't know what they're doing, and they often lose it all. Farming is a complicated business. So enter the farm school. They're dotted around the country, and they're not necessarily agricultural colleges, but rather hands-on farmer-mentored training programs. One of them is the Intervale Center in Burlington, Vermont. It's in its 25th year, and Travis Marcotte is executive director. Travis, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Travis, so you train farmers. How do you do this? How do you train a farmer at Intervale?
Well, Lynn, you know, we do a little bit of farmer training, and we do a lot of other things to strengthen our food system. We manage about 350 acres here in the city limits of Burlington, and we use that landscape as a farm-based incubator where beginning farmers can come and actually test out their business model here on our property.
So they're actually going to be growing on those acres and
Definitely. Yeah, we want people coming, you know, and really using it like an incubator, and they get access to equipment from greenhouses to tractors. And then I think most importantly, they gain access to what we call mentor farmers. So farmers who have great experience and knowledge that they can share with beginning farmers. And what we're looking for is folks that have some farm experience, have a business plan for their concept, you know, and really have demonstrated a lot of passion and kind of an understanding of, you know, how hard this undertaking is going to be. I mean, the exciting part of our program is that farmers can leave here much better prepared to then go to the bank, borrow that money, then own that farm. They're much better prepared to succeed once they've gone through the work here.
What's the hardest thing to teach?
Well, I think, you know, it's like any business or any career. You can't really teach the passion piece. And so you really got to make sure this is what people want to do. And if maybe they decide that the realities of it are not what they had kind of dreamed it would be, you know, it's a great way to take a different path in life and not feel like you've kind of risked it all on buying a farm.
Does it happen fairly often that people say, you know, I've just found out it's not for me?
Well, not so much in our program, you know, because there's a lot of work that we do on the front end.
Right, right.
But I think in farming in general, there's some, you know, real business aspects to farming that you need to be really engaged in. There's marketing that you have to do. So I think some folks do approach farming with this passion for growing things, but you also need to have that skill set around marketing and business management.
Let's talk about what else you do at Intervale.
Sure. It all stems from the place. So we manage this 350 acres that I talked about,
right,
and we do that in service to the community. So you have a place that's available for people to recreate and engage in farming. And then from there, we've really built a set of programs that help farmers get in business. So that's the incubator program.
Mm-hmm.
We do business planning statewide with all different kinds of farms. So that's the stay in business kind of program. For example, the Von Trapp Farmstead up in Waitsfield, Vermont, they came to us. They'd been milking cows, mom and dad, and the two sons wanted to come back to the farm. And in order for that farm to sustain the two sons and mom and dad, they thought if they added value to the milk in the form of cheese, then they could build a business that would really be successful for all of them. And so we helped them build a plan that allowed them to launch the Von Trapp Farmstead cheese line. And that was in 2007, I think, we started some work with them. And now they're very successful making cheese. And it's those kinds of examples of business planning that we do around the state of Vermont that really help people stay in business and thrive.
Travis, thanks for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Lynn.
Travis Marcotte is executive director of the Intervale Center in Burlington, Vermont. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Will Rogers, who said, "The farmer has to be an optimist, or he wouldn't still be a farmer." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Head to splendidtable.org for information on just about anything you heard here today. You're going to find information on our latest ebooks, podcasts. You can scroll through our recipe box, and you can register for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Manda Lilly. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.